This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the book-lined place in the metaverse where the top experts get 28 minutes to explain a big issue to us. This week, never mind the cost, will there be enough energy this winter? Impending Doom, Part 99. A few weeks ago, the Briefing Room looked in detail at energy bills as part of our programme on the cost of living crisis. But what if, whatever the cost, there just isn't enough power available to light our offices, heat our homes, and run our factories? Not just here, but in Europe too. How secure is our power supply? Step into the Briefing Room and we'll find out. First into the Briefing Room are Catherine Porter, an independent energy consultant who runs a company called What Logic, and Javier Blas, energy columnist at Bloomberg News. Catherine Porter, do you think that while we've been talking and agonising about the cost of energy, we should have been looking more closely at whether we're facing a problem of supply?
Well, I do. I mean, the problem of affordability is very serious and many households will be in difficulty this winter. So we can't deprioritise that. But there is also a risk that we will run out of electricity and we need to deal with that also.
Now, why is this? Let's go back to basics. How does the UK actually generate its electricity and where does it come from?
Well, most of our electricity is generated with gas, and gas-fired generation is the most important source of electricity in Britain. We've got nuclear power as well, although that's declining because the reactors are getting old and having to close. We've got various renewables, mostly wind, also some solar, a bit of hydro and some biomass. And then increasingly, we have interconnection with other countries, which should, in theory, provide us with imports.
Right. So who do we import energy from?
Most of our imports would normally be from France. We also have connections with Belgium, the Netherlands and Norway. Unfortunately, the connection with France is now running in export mode. So we're actually exporting to France rather than importing.
So we're sending electricity to France, but we're still getting it from Norway.
We are at the moment, yes. But the Norwegian Parliament is being recalled early from summer recess in 2 weeks' time to discuss potential restrictions on exports because they get their electricity mostly from hydroelectric resources and their reservoir levels have got very low, which is pushing up prices and leading to a risk of rationing in Norway.
Right. So in other words, they've not had the rainfall either and they haven't got the water for their own hydropower. And so as a consequence, we don't then get the electricity from them that we might expect.
Well, that's right. There's a risk of that. At the moment, we're still importing from Norway. But as I said, the Norwegian Parliament is looking at making a political decision to intervene in the market and restrict those exports.
Now, one of the things I'm wondering about with this supply of electricity in particular is whether or not, while we've been looking at all these other problems we've got, there have actually been problems of supply that have just about been managed, but we might not be able to manage in the future.
Well, that's certainly true. Each year, the situation gets worse because more thermal and nuclear power stations are closing and we're replacing them with wind. And unfortunately, if it's not windy, and we've had extended periods of low wind throughout July and August this year, then we will struggle to meet demand if we see those conditions in the winter.
And have we had any close calls?
We've had three occasions this summer when National Grid warned that we might run out of electricity. And as I said, in the winter, demand is so much higher that if we had the same situation in winter, it would be much closer and we could be looking at rationing at that point.
Have, are you also picking up concern from the people you talk to about the possibility of electricity shortages?
Very much so. What I will describe the level of concern is if you ask the government in public, they say everything is fine. You talk to people inside government and speak privately, they really are worried about the situation. If you go to the industry in public, they are quite worried about the situation, but they will say there is no risk of outages. If you speak privately to the people within the industry, the people who are buying and selling electricity every day for a living in the United Kingdom, they effectively tell you that we are sleepwalking into a crisis this winter and the things will get very, very tight with potential outages. At the moment, it seems that the policy of the government is you simply hope for the best.
Okay, now, we've already heard that some of our electricity, an important part of it, comes at certain times from France and Norway. What do you understand to be the problems with continuity of supply from those countries?
France relies on nuclear power and traditionally has been a huge exporter of electricity to the whole of Europe, not just the United Kingdom, but also Germany, Italy, even Spain. The nuclear fleet in France is suffering from multiple problems that has forced Electricité de France, the state-controlled company, to take offline more than half of the reactors of the country. Some of the reactors are going to come back into the winter, but it's still unclear whether France is going to have enough electricity for itself, and it may need to import. What's clear is that France is not exporting as in the past. Say, on average, over the last 10 years, France will be importing on a net basis perhaps 10, maybe 20 days a year. So far this year, in 2022, France has already imported on a net basis more than 100 days. We are just ending the summer. Still plenty of time for France to continue importing electricity.
Catherine, looking at that French situation, is this just a problem of the age of the reactors that will be solved fairly easily by a set of repairs, or are we looking at something that could last for a period of time?
Well, I think it's a problem that EDF hasn't really been maintaining its assets as well as it might.
That's the French electricity company.
That's right, yes. And it also has some issues with quality control within the organisation. So this isn't the first time that EDF has been required to take large numbers of its reactors offline for inspection and testing. The French nuclear regulator has just approved an inspection and repair programme for these reactors, which will take 3 years to complete. And then there's always the potential that some other problem is uncovered, as it has been in the past.
Javier, do you understand our government and our National Grid to have a plan in the event of big problems? Say France requires an enormous amount of its own energy and becomes an importer for most of the winter.
It's clear that National Grid is preparing for what we usually call a reasonable worst-case scenario that includes outages and blackouts, but the government in public is effectively saying they don't see this happening and they're playing down completely the eventuality. And I think that the government will be wiser coming clean to the public, to the voters, and explain the situation. At the end of the day, some of the problems that the United Kingdom is facing right now are our own making, bad policy. But many of the other problems are the result of external factors. Our policymakers have very little control. The troubles in France with the nuclear reactors, for example, the water level at the reservoirs in Norway is another one. And obviously the invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin, which has made gas extremely expensive. And explaining to the voters what could happen in a worst case scenario, I don't think that would be fear-mongering. I think it's just explaining to adults what the situation is and what the consequences could be.
Catherine, what could the government actually do, in addition to explaining things to people, in the short to medium term to reduce the electricity supply risk?
There are a number of measures it can take. It can try and increase the amount of generation available. So we've heard already that there have been negotiations with the operators of coal power stations to keep units that were due to close this year in the market. There are actually also two fairly large gas power stations, which are currently in mothballs and could return into the market, possibly not now for the start of winter, but maybe before the weather starts to get cold in sort of December, January time. And so I think the government should be negotiating with the owners of those generators to maybe get those back in the market. The government could also lift temporarily emission regulations, and that would encourage businesses to run backup diesel generation to reduce the stress on the grid. There's also a possibility that some of the older gas-fired large power stations could run on oil. And finally, there should be a coordination with the Norwegian government where we would make efforts to export electricity to Norway in the short term in exchange for them guaranteeing to export to us in the winter if we have a shortage.
Javier, a lot of the options that we've just been talking about are not cost-free in terms of emissions. Are there things that you think the government should be saying to the public about our use of power?
Yeah, just generally the message from the government should be are on a tight spot when it comes to energy supply right now. And if you can lower your consumption, even just a bit, it will be extremely helpful to the country at large if you could do that. It's not about nanny state. It's just about trying to help each other to make it through the winter.
Javier Blas there with Catherine Porter. Given those critical power links with Europe, I want to find out what the EU has been doing in response to the energy crisis. My next guest in the briefing room is Elisabetta Cornago, Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for European Reform in Brussels. Elisabetta Cornago, can you just briefly outline for us how the European Union has so far been responding to the energy crisis since Russia invaded Ukraine at the end of February?
The main policy action it has taken has been one thing called RepowerEU, which is essentially an energy security strategy aimed at phasing out Russian energy imports as quickly as possible, increasing what we already import from Norway and Algeria and the US, for example, to finding other suppliers as well. The second way, basically, in which the EU has been trying to encourage its member countries to react is by accelerating investment in alternatives to fossil fuels, and that's chiefly renewable energy. And the third, I would say, is reducing energy demand as quickly as possible to weather the storm and face potential shortfalls in gas supply, particularly. In July, EU members approved a plan to ensure that gas consumption is reduced by 15% between July and March to, you know, reduce demand as much as possible.
Has there been anything done about storage?
Yes, there are some specific actions related to gas. The first one, as you said, is a mandate to fill gas storage to at least 80% of its capacity EU-wide before winter. We're there, essentially, with differences across countries, but that's good news.
Going back to conservation for a moment, Germany announced made some announcements this week. Can you take us through those?
This week, the German government did announce a more structured, let's say, energy saving plan. And some examples of what we find in there is that large gas-consuming companies are going to be asked to implement energy-saving measures in an obligatory way. So other measures range from banning overnight illuminated advertising to reducing also illumination on public landmarks and buildings to lowering heating temperatures in public buildings and public offices to 19 degrees. There's also a range of measures that basically aim at better informing households with respect to how they can go about saving energy. And so that is going to be putting essentially the burden in a way on energy providers and landlords, asking them to inform residential consumers, households, of how energy prices are evolving and how they can go about then cutting their consumption to maintain their bills lower.
What is the EU planning to do next?
Gas and electricity prices are reaching new highs. And this is really, I think, what is top of mind of European leaders. And so this is the reason why next Friday there will be an extraordinary meeting of EU energy ministers to discuss what emergency measures the EU as a whole could take, but also what longer-term reforms it should undertake. It is possible that leaders are going to be discussing some kind of price cap on the use of gas in electricity generation to precisely decouple power and gas prices. It's going to be controversial because there's some tension between, you know, trying to put a lid on prices in a way, but also ensuring that consumers are continuously encouraged to reduce their demand. So there's that, I guess, difficult balance to strike.
Are you saying, in effect, that actually high energy prices, if left high, would have the effect of reducing consumer demand, thus making the guarantee of supply easier?
That's a bit what the theory tells us, but it's also what we've partly seen from data flowing in terms of how consumers have been responding to the energy price evolution that we've seen in the past year, right? We are already seeing much higher electricity and gas prices relative to pre-war.
Elisabetta Cornago. Finally, what about us? And just to remind you, we're talking here not about gas prices, but about energy supply. How well placed is Britain to deal with possible shortages, and what can we do to avert them? Joining me in the briefing room are David Shepherd, energy editor at the Financial Times, and Michael Bradshaw, professor of global energy at the University of Warwick. David Shepherd, we've just been hearing about the EU's plans for an urgent reform of the energy market. Now, how have the gas markets responded to that?
We have seen gas prices weaken a little bit over the course of the last week. When we got these announcements coming out around looking at reforming the electricity and gas markets and trying to break the link between gas pricing and electricity pricing, some traders believe that fed through a little bit and helped to weaken the gas price somewhat, though it's not entirely clear exactly how much of an influence that had overall.
Michael Bradshaw, can we say anything useful about the impact on gas prices in the medium term that changes like this might have?
I think, as David has highlighted, the market is extremely volatile at the moment. The major problem is that Russia is restricting the flow of gas to Europe, and Europe is trying to find alternative sources of gas, primarily liquefied natural gas on the world market. And there just isn't enough gas. And therefore, there's a kind of a bidding war going on out there, and high prices are having to be paid. So in the medium term, there's not much evidence that that's going to change. There's no obvious new source of gas on the horizon for some years to come.
Yeah, so not especially volatile downwards. And I imagine that despite the fact that Britain is obviously not in the EU, that's not going to be very different for us either.
Not at all, because actually we are in competition. You could think of us as between a rock and a hard place in some ways. On the one hand, we need to compete with European prices. And on the other hand, we have to compete globally. And so the price that we have to pay is going to be high enough to attract the gas that we need in the face of growing competition.
Michael, we were hearing earlier in the programme about the possibility of problems with the electricity supply, that bit of the electricity we get from France and Norway for very specific reasons. And now we've just been talking about the problems of supply of gas. How risky is the supply of gas to Britain going to be this winter, do we think?
Well, I think we're in a better place than many European countries, because about half of the gas that we consume, we produce in the North Sea, and about a remaining 30% comes from Norway via pipelines directly to the UK. It's that balance, the 20% that comes largely as liquefied natural gas through the terminals that we have, and a small amount will come from Europe through the interconnectors. And it's that sort of flexible element that's really at risk. If something happens in Europe and we can't source gas from Europe from their storage, equally, if there's a very limited supply of LNG coming into the UK, then things could get difficult.
Liquefied natural gas. By getting very difficult, what do we mean? And do you mean, to use a cliche, there's a risk of a perfect storm situation?
Much depends on what happens elsewhere in the world. For example, if there is a cold winter in Asia, that will draw liquefied natural gas away from Europe to Asia as part of this bidding war that I talked about. So we have to hope for a mild winter and benign market conditions. But the bottom line is there's simply not enough of gas out there.
Right. Can we stick with your point about storage for a moment? Why don't we have enough storage? I mean, do we have less than other countries do? And if we do have less, why do we? And can't we build it up?
Well, historically, we didn't, because we simply opened the taps from production from the North Sea and surged production in the winter months. But we did build some longer term strategic storage, a facility called Rough, which is a depleted gas field in the North Sea. But back in 2017, the owners of the Rough facility said it was kind of past its sell by date, and they weren't willing to invest in maintaining it. And the government decided it wasn't going to support the maintenance of the Rust facility. And so that was 70% of our gas storage. And that was long-term storage, which would be used in winter months to help balance the domestic market. We don't have that. Now, in recent weeks, there's been discussion with Centrica Storage about reinstating Rough as a storage facility. And there's some discussion about how quickly and how viable that might be. But I think the government is probably rueing that decision back in 2017.
David Shepherd, you've presumably been also looking at the situation facing European policymakers. From what you can tell, how worried are they about the prospects for this winter?
I think it's fair to say that they're incredibly worried right now. The prospect of a complete shut-off of Russian gas is very real. The one bright spot is that Europe has done a pretty good job of filling its storage facilities so far this year. They're up to about 80% now in the EU, which is the level that they were targeting to reach by November. And we've obviously reached that by the beginning of September. So we should be heading into winter with full storage in the EU. But that's not to say that they're home and hosed. Storage will get drawn down in the winter, even when Russian capacity was coming full steam ahead into Europe. Without Russian capacity or with severely curtailed Russian supplies, that storage is going to draw very, very quickly. So they're looking already at curbing demand where they can, most countries. So there are measures being taken, but it's already a very difficult situation beyond just the price. And I think one of the critical things is at the moment, the market and politicians are hoping for a lot of very benign scenarios that Michael alluded to earlier. You do not want to see a major pipeline from the North Sea go down this winter. But these things happen. You're running the pipeline at very high capacity and have been for the last 18 months or so to try and offset what's been going on with Russia. You can have all manner of things go wrong. You could even have a hurricane in November, say, in the Gulf of Mexico in the US that damages LNG terminals. These are the types of things that we see in a regular market, and the average person in the street wouldn't really notice them because the market is big enough and flexible enough to backfill when something goes wrong. This market's on a knife edge right now.
There's been quite a lot of talk, Michael, about things that we could do in the medium term to produce more energy at home, more licensing for drilling in the North Sea. Some people have even been talking about fracking. What's your understanding about the contribution that any of those things could make to solving the problem in the medium term?
I think it's a question of timeframes here. I mean, there are probably some smaller fields, incremental fields, that could be brought into production fairly quickly within months or years. But developing new fields is going to take a long time. So that's not an immediate solution to the problem. But making sure that everything we have in the North Sea is fully functional and hoping we don't have a major interruptions is going to be critically important. And that's true of the existing pipelines as well as platforms. I think fracking, which is something I spend a great deal of time working on, probably more than it justifies, is really not part of the short-term answer. I know statements are being made by the industry that they could deliver gas within 12 to 18 months. I just don't believe they're ever going to reach the scale and pace to make a difference in the UK. I know the Tory leadership candidates have said that they would allow fracking where communities support it. But all the research I've seen suggests that there are no communities that are going to support it. We also have a very small shale industry that's in sleep mode. So I don't really see that as a solution either. It will probably cause more upset in the short term in terms of negative reactions from communities.
Now, David Shepherd, if we did get to the stage of actual shortages, there wasn't enough power this winter, what would the national grid do? What happens under those circumstances?
An outright shortage of gas, it can be very, very serious. They have to take immediate measures to try and balance the system. Because otherwise, if pressure falls too low on the national gas network, it can cause real long-term damage to infrastructure, to pipelines, to all manner of things. And in that quite extreme scenario of a genuine outright shortage, they would need to do things such as shut off the interconnector pipelines that run back to the EU. They would need to call on industry to immediately reduce demand. They would even need to potentially tell households to turn down heating. Anything they can do to cut that demand quickly in that scenario. Though that's particularly extreme.
I'm so old now that I remember the blackouts in 1973, Michael. Are there plans which would include things like that? I mean, could I look forward to my adolescent history being repeated?
Unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember the blackouts and the three-day week as well. As David mentioned, I mean, there are all sorts of contingency plans in place. And in fact, National Grid is going to be running an exercise in the coming weeks called Exercise Degree, which it's going to be testing the system and looking how the system would manage with all sorts of different scenarios. I think blackouts and reduced availability, I mean, that's kind of the last resort. But as David also said, we're in a very precarious situation here. Not, you know, everything that could go wrong seems to be going wrong at the moment, you know, broadly in Europe in terms of the electricity system. So I think it's quite natural to plan for the worst case scenarios. I mean, there are plans in place to ask particular consumers, industry first, for example, to reduce consumption or shut down or whatever. So I think we should be assured that plans are in place. There are contingency and scenarios are run to deal with these systems, but mainly they're there to deal with when we have either a technical problem or an extreme weather problem. If you remember the beast from the east, we're in uncharted territory here in terms of an unprecedented geopolitical threat that could see the complete shutdown of gas supplies into Europe. I think if that were to happen, then yes, we're going to be looking at all eventualities and a very difficult situation to manage.
Well, one obvious question then to both of you is whether the new prime minister in place very shortly would be wise to convene a COBRA meeting as soon as possible to discuss these sorts of things, David.
I would think so. I mean, the scale of the crisis we are facing is huge. You know, people, very staid people I speak to in the industry who are generally very steady and balanced and measured in their views are talking about we need to move on to a war footing. Because whether we like it or not, that is what we're witnessing here. We are in an economic war of sorts. And the UK is, in many ways, at risk right now. We have an electricity system which is more reliant on gas than most countries in Europe. We may be less reliant than many countries in the EU on Russian gas coming in for heating our homes and so on. But the UK overall is incredibly reliant on gas because of our history of the North Sea. We still get 40 to 50% of our electricity from burning gas. We heat the vast majority of our homes with gas. The UK does have some exposure here, and we need to take it seriously. So far, the UK government hasn't wanted to go down the road of asking people to cut demand, cut consumption. And there are some reasonably sound reasons for that. It's a hard thing to do safely and you don't necessarily want to move too early at a time when the UK is not yet experiencing physical shortages. But we could do this winter and sort of any amount of gas saved at this time, that includes that used to generate electricity, seems sensible in this scenario.
Michael, do you agree?
Yes, very much so. I mean, back in March, I gave evidence to a parliamentary select committee on energy security and raised this question of demand, more from a point of view of a bill payer than an expert, saying that, you know, we probably would benefit from having some sort of public campaign to put in place measures to try and reduce energy consumption, making sure our windows are properly insulated, for example, turning down, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about turning down a gas boiler. I think you need to get technical assistance to do that safely, but also thinking through to the winter about, you know, rooms you don't heat and so on and so forth. On the margins, all of these things can make a difference. And if we can manage down the peaks in demand, that also makes the network easier to consume. The most affordable molecule or electron is the one that you don't consume. So I really think that we should have done more, and it's still not too late. We do need to do more. Why not set the same sort of target that the European Union has? It's a win-win in a sense, because we're also saving money on our energy bills. So I think it should be a matter of priority for whoever's in number 10 this time next week, that we get the message across that we need to conserve energy this coming winter.
Michael Bradshaw there and David Shepherd. And my conclusion at the end of all that is, turn down the thermostat and stop dreaming of a white Christmas. My thanks to Catherine Porter, Javier Blas, Elisabetta Cornago, David Shepherd and Michael Bradshaw. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirstine Knight, Paul Connolly and Simon Watts. The studio manager was James Beard and the editor is Richard Barden. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune in to the one about the best policy to deal with the cost of living crisis, or there's a programme about how to clean up Britain's filthy rivers.
The dumbest genre in entertainment? or the one that tells us the most about ourselves?
Reality TV is not just a mirror of the world that we live in. It is shaping the future of the world that we live in.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Unreal, a critical history of reality TV.
If you go on that show, it's effectively like getting a ticket to the chocolate factory.
I'm journalist and broadcaster Pandora Sykes.
And I'm investigative journalist Shirin Kale.
In this 10-part audio documentary, we'll be bringing an analytical eye to a genre that we have both grown up with.
I had no idea that it would pretty much taken over Britain.
Over the last 6 months, we've rewatched hundreds.
Seriously, hundreds.
Of hours of some of the most formative reality shows ever made and spoken to some of their biggest names.
I had no idea how much of your reality actually comes out on reality TV.
This is Unreal, a critical history of reality TV. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.